Good morning.
Glad I didn't get it on here.
Good morning.
Today is
that Helen Gross there? Helen, welcome.
And we all extend our condolences to you on the passing of Alex. Good man. All right. I'm not calling to. You should be Zeicher, Avichai Sharon, Yishanim, and Nachas, and your children and grandchildren, and great grandchildren.
All right.
Now, this is one of those shiurim where I don't know whether I'm going to go off into all sorts of places. I have so much to say, and it's. You know what, I'll just start at the beginning, and if we have to extend the shiur over another week or so, it doesn't really make any difference. Now, you won't believe it, but the shiur is based on a Sirah Honig. If you had, how many shiurim in this country or in the world are based on Sirah Honig? Sarah Honig is one of the great writers of the Jerusalem Post every Friday in the second section. So, you know, you have to go through the women page by page. The very last page is, of course, Carolyn Glick, but you can leave Carolyn Glick for second. Now, on the other side of Carolyn Glick, you usually have Greer Faye Cashman. Right. I run from that. From that page I run, unless of course I see Rena Quinn's name someplace over there. Right? How am I doing?
Good. You're doing good.
now a page, the next page is one of the greatest pages of all. It's Sarah Honig at the top and Uri Savir at the bottom. Uri Savir is as left as you can go. I don't think he has a right side to his body. He's all left. Sarah Honig is, of course, all right. So on that page, you have right and left, and it's unbelievable. Two different worlds. Now, this is very important information I'm giving you. This. And then you go to the next page. So you usually will have David Weinberg. David Weinberg, he's good. He's getting better all the time. His wife grew up in my community in West Hempstead. Where he grew up? He grew up in Toronto. Bella?
Yeah.
David grew up in... So here it is. I was rabbi in Toronto, and then I was rabbi in West Hempstead, and... Toronto shul boy marries a West Hempstead shul girl, and you got David Weinberg and his wife, Bonnie. All right, okay. So on that next page, you have Liat Collins, who is very good. And below her, you have Martin Sherman. Have I given you the whole picture now? So now we're going to a ceremony. There was something, there's a history to this. I'm going to read, and I'm going to explain. And you're going to see, believe me, don't have faith in me. Let's put it, Rav Soloveitchik, I remember hearing him say it with such vehemence. We dare never have faith in any human being. We may trust a human being, but we can't have faith in them. So therefore, I'm not saying have faith in me, just trust me that it's going to be very, very appropriate for the Seder, which is Parashat Shlach. By the way, Rav Soloveitchik said in the context of a period of time when we began to know already what Franklin Delano Roosevelt could have done for the Jews and didn't do for the Jews. And he says, I accuse nobody. I'm not attacking anybody. I only ask myself, why didn't I run into the streets of Boston and cry out as Mordechai of old had done? Because we had faith in Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Never have faith in any human being. Now we've continued to find out more and more about what could have been done. And we've talked about that in the past. But all right, here we are with... So just trust me that it's very much related to the Sefer. In his milestone, I'm reading Sarah Honey, in his milestone, still ever relevant 1943 book, The Forgotten Ally, Dutch-Canadian journalist Pierre Van Passen quotes his own interview with the British Mandate's acting High Commissioner, Harry Luke, during the homicidal countrywide Arab rampages of 1929, most notorious for the Hebron Massacre. I think there are very few people in the world that have Pierre Van Passen's book, The Forgotten Ally. I'm one of those few people in the world. Don't anybody even dream of borrowing it from me. This does not leave my possession. I was introduced to this book by my oldest brother, Rabbi Yosef Yoel Gold. I most probably was about 13 or 14 years old. That goes back about 65 years ago. And there were a number of years that I didn't have it, and some years back in a second-hand bookstore in Yerushalayim, I found a copy of The Forgotten Ally. Don't look with such lustful eyes. This book was printed in 1943, in the middle of the war. Pierre Van Passen, Dutch-Canadian, but one of the great Ohavei Yisrael lovers of Israel. And the whole book is about the forgotten ally. In 43, he's writing, the thrust of the book is that Great Britain, America, had one ally, and he predicts that this ally is going to be forgotten when the war is going to be over and they're going to sit down to divide the spoils of war. This ally will be forgotten. And that's going to be a profound act of ingratitude and treachery and betrayal. Who is the forgotten ally? The forgotten ally, the Palestinians. Jews! In the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the Palestinians were the Jews. And he describes in great detail how Britain's war effort that brought about Hitler's first defeat at El Alamein, Egypt, North Africa, at the end of October, beginning of November, 1942, the first defeat of Hitler. And after that, it signaled the beginning of the end. Hitler was then, Rommel's forces, the Desert Fox, was ready for his final thrust from El Alamein to Alexandria and then into Eretz Yisrael. And in Eretz Yisrael, they say two things were happening. Number one, a third of the people, the Jews in Eretz Yisrael, were walking with poison pills in their pocket. If Hitler comes in, there would be a matzava. They were also preparing for a last stand on Har HaCarmel. They were going to turn Mount Carmel into Matsada too. Because Hitler was simply unstoppable. Rommel, the Desert Fox. And then June, July, August, September, Rommel was bringing in all sorts of forces and equipment. The British were, and everything was leading up to the great battle, and so much the fate of Eretz Yisrael hung up on that battle. And Pierre Van Passen describes that without the Palestinians, Britain would have lost the Battle of El Alamein. A quarter of Montgomery's soldiers were Jews from Palestine. A quarter of his army were Jews who had volunteered to fight in the British Army. The materials that he needed, and he lists pages of materials that were being produced by 7,000 factories in Eretz Yisrael. Everything from medical equipment to ammunition. There were only 430,000 Jews in Eretz Yisrael then. 430,000 Jews. And the 430,000 Jews of Eretz Yisrael changed the tide completely. They were the force that gave Montgomery the power to break through Rommel's forces and begin the rout of Hitler. But he says, when the war is going to be over, the Jews are going to be forgotten. At the same time that he describes what the Jews were doing for the British Army, he describes the joy and the glee in Arab countries who are preparing for the great day when Rommel breaks through at El Alamein and begins his march to Palestine. They were waiting to celebrate. The Mahdi was in Jerusalem behind Hitler all the way. And he says, you know, after the war, you know what's going to happen? I mean, the meal is unbelievable. They're going to forget their real ally, the one who helped them come to the first great victory. And he describes the exploits of these Palestinian Jews, the things that they did behind German lines, Freidlich, what they did. It was unbelievable. There were towns in North Africa that were captured by 90 Palestinian fighters came in and took over a whole city. It's unbelievable. The Rebellion was already... and then, of course, there was some time ago that I told you the story of the 500 Palestinian Jews who were given a job by the British to create a minefield in the Sahara in order to slow down Rommel's tanks. They held out, 500 of them, held out against German forces for one whole month until July 1st or July 2nd of 42. They remained with only 45 fighters. All the rest were wiped out. The bombings and the attacks, it's unbelievable that they held out that long. And I remember when I told you that story, on the last day, it's all over, so they're either ready to die in the desert, and then all of a sudden they see a convoy of jeeps and trucks coming with those were in better days, with the French tricolor. You always get choked up at this point. And here it is, they meet up and we're taking you home. And the commander of the French forces saw the still living commander of the Palestinian Jews wrapping something up and putting it in his bag. He says, wait, what's that? He said, it's our flag. They had our flag. And he says, he put it into his jeep. That's our flag. He was General Pierre Koenig. So now you may have learned why there's a big street in Talpiot called Pierre Koenig. Anyway, Pierre Van Passen, in this book that is, it's priceless, the book is priceless. So he describes what the Palestinians did for the British Army. Understand? At the same time, that the British were stopping unseaworthy boats in the Mediterranean from getting to Eretz Yisrael. It's unbelievable. The power that fuels the first victory against Hitler is by Jews. And they're stopping Jews. They have nothing better to do with His Majesty, His Majesty's great fleet is to stop Jews who are trying to escape Hitler and get to safety. It's unbelievable. The story is unbelievable. All right. But here, this part is a... he's interviewing a fellow by the name of Harry Luke. Harry Luke was the acting High Commissioner for Palestine at the time. In other words, he was the ranking British commander of Palestine. And this is in the middle of the 1929 Tov Resh Peites, the Hevra massacre. Van Passen told Luke, "You arrested first and foremost, in every case I investigated, the Jews who successfully defended themselves. You arrested 50 Jews in Haifa. At the moment they defended themselves heroically against the attack of a mob of some 2,000 runners amok." Luke had told him, "We're doing something." The fact is, Arabs were massacring Jews, and the British stood by, did nothing, didn't lift a finger. So Pierre Van Passen is in Eretz Yisrael at the time, and he interviews this High Commissioner. So the High Commissioner told him, "Oh, well, you know, we arrested people." He says, "I know you arrested people. You arrested the people who were defending themselves. Why didn't you do anything with the attackers? You did nothing." Yesterday, this is Pierre Van Passen telling Harry Luke, "Yesterday I saw a man brought into Jerusalem by the mounted police and recognized in him an older settler from the neighborhood of Lifter, the owner of a small canning factory, who had been in this country for more than 50 years, a real pioneer. I visited this man in jail. His name is Isaac Brozen. He was arrested after he had barricaded himself in his factory. Arabs from Lifter raped and massacred his old wife and two daughters and set fire to his house across the roadway." Luke, like Obama, Kerry, and Hody EU omniscience, all these decades later, argued that he was only looking out for the Jews. He arrested them to keep them in protective custody. In other words, because we know better what's good for the Jews than they know what's good for themselves. This is the comparison that she's making. Luke, in 1929, he knew what's better. Argued that he was only looking out for Jews. He was trying to get them past their own intransigence to see what's best for them, something they were clearly incapable of doing. According to this self-appointed ad hoc benefactor of the Jews, Brozen and the many others Van Passen listed were merely placed in protective custody for their own good. The interviewer countered when he told him that we only arrested them to protect them. So Pierre Van Passen tells this Greiser Tzaddik, Harry Luke, he tells him, "But they were in chains and in solitary confinement. Mr. Brozen was loaded down on the chains on his hands and chains on his feet, old Turkish chains at that, and you're trying to tell me that you're protecting him?" Van Passen's now rare value. Again, don't look with lust. Van Passen's now rare volume is a must-read for anyone who seeks to place the Israel-Arab conflict in perspective. It is saliently precisely because it was written long before Israel had been aligned as the imperialist ogre of present-day political fashion. There was no state, there were no settlements, and the story was the same. Neither Kerry nor Psaki can remotely be suspected of ever having heard of Pan Van Passen, or of ever having read a line of his output, much less of being broad-minded enough to change their minds if they had. Nevertheless, there's no disputing that the more things change, the more they stay the same. impartial Brits once sought to foil Jewish defense with chains. New imperial State Department hacks strive to foil Jewish defense with different, no less constructive and vindictive shackles. Now, I keep reading, this is only one small part of the interview between Pierre and Passon and Harry Luke. There's so much more. Luke told him, I don't have enough troops here to protect the Jews. Troops are on the way from Malta. So Pierre and Passon asked him, do you have rifles? Do you have guns? Oh yeah, thousands. So he said, give them out to the Jews. They'll protect themselves. Oh, no. I have to be neutral. If I give them arms, I'm not neutral anymore. So you're going to let them be killed. You have to read this whole thing. It's like madness. Madness. Same madness that goes on Haidel Nasser. 70 years later. What does it have to do with us? So let's go to number two. By the way, this is an act of greatness on my part that I'm able to leave the book right now and start talking more toward the parasha, because the book is a classic. The classic. All right, anyway, here it is. Sometimes things just fall into place and I didn't mean to do anything. They just come popping up at me. I read Sarah Honig every week, and of course when I read this, that there's somebody left in the world that knows about Pierre Van Passon and the Forgotten Ally. I haven't met anybody in 50 years. If I'd be half an inch, I'd send her an email saying, Hodul Hashem Yitov, there's one person in the world aside from me that knows about the Forgotten Ally. What?
I know about Pierre Van Passon.
You know about Pierre Van Passon?
I was a kid.
Because you were part of my generation.
What's that?
We're part of the same generation.
That's right. It was discussed in my house, Pierre Van Passon.
He what?
He was an icon figure.
An icon figure. And an Ohev Yisrael of the highest order. Oh! The Meshach Hasban will give you some more. So then after I read Sarah Honig, I picked up Hanan Porat Sefer on Sefer Gamidbar, and I'm looking at Parshat Shlach. Watch this. Harav Zatzal, Rav Kook was then the chief rabbi. Lo machal lo salach la shulton habriti. He never forgave the British administration, Shashitev Pu'ulakim HaPorim HaRavim. They collaborated with the Arab terrorists. Interesting, I remember Pierre Van Passon says, you know who they attacked in 1929? All the enclaves in Eretz Yisrael where the Yishuv HaYashar lived. Mm-hmm. They didn't go into any of the kibbutzim or the yishuvim where these young tzionim chilayim were. They went there to Tzfat, Yerushalayim, Chevron. Oh God. Pierre Van Passon tells Harry Luke, I was there in the house of Rabbi Slonim in Hebron. They massacred Rabbi Slonim and his whole family. And I think he said, Pierre Van Passon said, there were 28 dead bodies there. Luke tells him, no, only 27. Listen to this. So he says, no, don't tell me 27. There were 27 adults and there was a 3-month-old child baby that had also been massacred. Then he spoke, no, they didn't kill 28, they killed 27. Rav Kook did not forgive. Well, by the way, okay, Ubimyuchal Charles Luke. Now, if you have the same question that I have, sorry, Sarah Honig talks about Harry Luke, and Hanan Korat talks about Charles Luke. So it took me about 30 seconds to bring up Luke on the computer. He was Harry Charles Luke. So Hanan Korat is right, and Sarah Honig is right, and Pierre Van Passen is right. Anyway, he never forgave him. He was the Mazkir Memshelet HaMandat, the Secretary of the Mandatory Powers, Shahaya Achra'il Medinyot. So he was the one who was responsible for the policy of the British government. They permitted the Arabs to kill, to murder, to rape, to destroy. V'sapro Rav Avrom Yitzhak HaKohen Kuk Malachim V'Kunei Doro V'Saper Simcha Raz. Simcha Raz wrote a book about the he talks about Rav Kook, and he the following incident he says, Beit Kabbalat Panim de Schmidt Sharacham Emsholat Hamandar Botam Yamin Linechvedei Yishuv Yehudi. There was a reception that the British mandatory government made for the notables of the Jewish community. So at that reception, Charles Luke is there, Charles Harry Luke, and Rav Kook. And Charles Luke extends his hand to Rav Kook. Et yado l'rav l'birchat shalom, let's say hello. Harav sidev l'chotz et yado. Rav Kook refused to shake his hand, and he said with a strong voice, I don't shake the hands of somebody whose hands are filthy with blood, the blood of Jews.
Jewish
blood. That was Rav Kook. Bo'ta pegisha, at that gathering, Luke said to Rav Kook, Atem ha'yehudim, you Jews, heygenu al atzmakem, you defend yourselves. Don't you start up and attack anybody. You understand? So Rav Kook responded to him by telling him, you who transgress, lo tirtzach shalt not kill, don't you give us Musa. You're the last one to tell us what to do. End of Geyozu, this proud position that was taken by Rav Kook, made a tremendous impression on people in Eretz Yisrael at the time. Bechol Olam HaYehudi, the whole Jewish world. And there was a writer by the name of Avigdor HaMeiri who said with great feeling, Lule Ish Echad Yochid Miuchad, if not for this one single solitary human being, Sha'amad Al Mishmar Kvodeinu HaLumi V'Enoshi, who stood up for our national and human honor, we would have to tear Kriya for the death of our honor and our dignity. Rav Kook stood up for the honor of the Jewish people. He was strong. All right, which brings me to maybe I would say the forgotten hero of Parshat Shlach. There's only one hero in Parshat Shlach. Shlach is a parasha of tragedy. The Meratlim, they bring tragedy upon an entire generation. They come back with their report. Jews are terrified, they're frightened, they're not going to go. But there's one man who saves the honor and dignity of the Jewish people. Watch. The Medrash Tanchuma says, Vayahas Kolev et ha'am. In the Pasuk it says, Kolev, silence the people. Shh. He was the only one who was able to silence them. All the people are, they're crying, they're screaming, they're upset, we can't go. Vayas Kalev at home. Shebetchil Amalem, you know what Kalev had done? At first he told them, Raglim, Ani imachem be'etzachav, I'm with you. I'm on the same side. I'm with you. I'm with you. Ubelipo haya, in his heart, he had decided long ago, lomar emet, to say the truth. Shenema, as it says, and we're going to read these psukim later, vo'asheva tol davar kashedim levavi. Kalev, 45 years later, they are already in Eretz Yisrael. The 40 years are up, they're in Eretz Yisrael. They've conquered the land, and Kalev comes to Yehoshua ben Nun, and he says to him, I answered kashedim levavi, I spoke what was in my heart. V'achai Asher, olu imi himsiv, my brothers who came up with me, the other miraculum himsiv, they weakened the hearts of the Jewish people. The Chenakodesh Baruch Hu Meidol, the Holy One, blessed be He, testifies about Kalev, Shenema, the Avdi Kalev Ekev Hata Ruach Hacheret, my servant Kalev, because he had a different spirit, the Ruach Hacheret of Kalev. And we're going to have to try to find what was this Ruach Hacheret of Kalev. Kishabola Meraglim, when the Meraglim came back home, they said, Neman Aleinu Kalev. They said, Kalev, we can trust him. They can trust him. We can have faith in Kalev. So you know what he did? Miyad Amar Al Asafso. I mean, it sounds like Hyde Park. No. He took a bench. He got up on a bench. And there it was. He stands up. The Shitek at Koyasol, he silenced all of Israel. Shoyu Mesichim al Moshe, they were all talking against Moshe. Vayas Kolev et Sva'om el Moshe, and Kolev silenced the people to Moshe. Vayin, are you Surin? You know what they all thought? Sheyia om el Lashon Hara. They thought he's going to say the same Lashon Hara that they're saying. Lashon Hara? Therefore, everybody was silent. They're waiting to hear. You're going to hear what Kalev has to say now. Pasach v'amar. So he got up and he opened and he said, Alona alevi arashno ota. We're going to go up and we're going to inherit the land. Ki yachol nuchala. We can do it. And write that sentence more until Bama started using, oh yes, we can. The one who said it first was Kalev ben Yefuna. Alone, Arleh, we will go up and we will inherit. Ki yachol nuchalo, we will be able to do it. Miyad kisheshamu kach, when they heard this, cholku kinegdo, they started arguing with him, the Amru, and they said, lo nuchalo, we can't go up. Because he, the people of the land are stronger mimenu than him. Gemara says, you know what the Mother Rabbi was saying? You know who the him is? The capital H-I-M. They are stronger than him. What's fascinating is Kalev ben Yefuna doesn't get up there and speak the same language as the Meraglim. The language of the Meraglim was, they're stronger, they're more powerful, they're living in fortified cities. We saw the giants there. It's just militarily impossible for us to conquer the land. So now he had one of two options. One option was that he would say, no, it's not true. Well, we do have, we have 600,000 men under arms. We can outflank them on the right, outflank them on the left. We can send in paratroopers. We can use battering rams. We'll mow them down with our bows and arrows.
No, no, no.
He doesn't deal with that at all. He doesn't touch it. He makes a profound statement that is so unrealistic.
Alone, our lad, we're going to go up. We can do it.
On what basis, I pray tell us, Khalid, on what basis do you say we can do it? On what basis? You know what Khalid is doing? He is making a statement of profound faith. If we would want to translate that into present day kind of talk, Khalid is messianic. Khalid is, you know, one of these wild guys up on the heights of the Shomron with the long pays and the big pot, kippot. He's not living in the world of reality. Khalid Ben Yefuna is a dreamer. He's a visionary. We're living with 2 feet on solid ground. We have to be able to look at the reality of the situation. He's most probably a right winger. I mean, obviously these people don't know what's best. Don't you understand? Do you know what the disengagement is going to do for us? It's going to make us the darlings of the world. Oh, it'll make us the darlings of the world. And you know what? It's going to guarantee that this country is going to be a Jewish and democratic state. Well, they're going to shoot rockets.
Yeah, they're not going to shoot no rockets. And if they're going to shoot rockets, we'll just go in there and wipe them out.
So, you know, Cohen, you can keep your dreams, you know, for another day. We're not interested in that kind of talk. But that's how he talks. He doesn't disagree with them on any of the details that, you know, maybe we can do it, we can't do it. No,
I have a plan. Later, Klal Yisrael are already there, it's so long they've conquered the country.
Khalid is still alive, he's 85 years old. He was 40 years old at the time that he was of the Meraglim, and he comes to Moshe, to Yoshua, and he says, you know, God promised me that Hebron will be mine, I want it. You know, 45 years later, the big realists, the ones who live on solid ground, the ones who are able to look at the situation with absolute clarity, they're the ones that were all wrong. They're gone. The dreamer, the visionary, the fellow who doesn't seem to inhabit the world of reality, called Khalid Ben Yefuna, he's there. And I love, he says, Kikochi Oz. Kochi Ata. The same strength that I had 45 years ago, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go now. There are so many parallels in today's world. Maybe we'll save that for another time. It's all right. I came under a lot of attack, don't be wrong, I'm not going to paint myself as a colleague, but each one of us, in our own little way, today's the last day. No, I'm just saying, you know, I said at the beginning of this year I may go off into a tangent, so I'm going to tangent around, especially today. It's Mr. Peres's last day in office as president, so here it was. What's today's date?
The tenth.
Well, it's too far. I wrote it on my. It's the 10th day of June. Oh, all right. I'm sorry. This is gonna. I got it. On June 13th, 1995. I'm taking you back. June 13th, 1995. I led 150 rabbis in America to Washington. We spent June 13, 1995 in Washington, D.C. The background for the story is that by the time Pesach of 95 arrived, those of us who were involved in the struggle against Oslo, there was nothing left for us to do. We had demonstrated, we had signed petitions, we had stood on the highways, don't give them weapons. We had done everything. So a few of us conspirators, we were then working with Rav Avraham Shapira, and we had an apartment in Kiryat Moshe. I won't tell you where it is. I don't know who's using it these days. So we sat down, what are we going to do next? So somebody came up with the idea that the scene of battle is now shifting to Washington, because a bill was presented to Congress by the administration to give $500 million to the new Palestinian Authority.
Yes.
So we decided, you know what? We're going to move the battle to Washington as well. And here we conspirators in our apartment in Kiryat Moshe, but of course it was the nerve center. We had all sorts of things going on. We decided we're going to, I don't want to sound too grandiose, but it was pretty good. In 1943 or 44, Reb Lazer Silver brought 400 rabbis to Washington. And in 1995, Gold is going to bring a few hundred rabbis to Washington. And we began the plans. There was a lot of planning involved. We needed a lot of money. So I think Rav Avraham Shapira, Zechut Tzadik, the Kodesh, the Bracha, tells me, for this we have to talk to Dr. Moskowitz, Dr. Irving Moskowitz, okay? So I call him up from Rav Avraham's office. Dr. Moskowitz, this is our plan, and we need money to get this plan rolling. So send me a budget. Okay, we sat down, budget? The budget we sent him was $72,000. The next day I called him, Irving, you got the budget yet? So I asked him, I'd like you to give me $50,000 in that budget. So he says, oh no. My heart went down like, oh God. Everything was dependent on him. I'm paying every penny. Nobody else is going to have any share of that. We'll save it for another time, but basically with a tremendous amount of work, we spent about 5 weeks in with one break in Eretz Yisrael in the United States putting together this group. One of the people who helped us most was Rav Pesach Lerner, who was the head of Young Israel. He bussed in on June 13th in the morning. He bussed in over 100 rabbis from New York. There were other rabbis that came from other places. We had about 150 rabbis. We started off by the Lincoln Memorial. Famous. We had a prayer session at the Lincoln Memorial, and then we had a breakfast in a park nearby, and then we spent hours going from one senator to the next. Senators, congressmen, don't it? But I remember Gershom Yachtelson, who was the editor of the famed Allgemeine Journal, told me, you know, we all got calls this morning from Paris that we shouldn't cover this event. That's my parting shot to the president as he goes off today. Anyway, 20 years later, by the way, they passed the $500 million for the, and all we did, by the way, I made it clear to all of the rabbis, we are not disagreeing with the policy of the Israeli government. We're just asking that they don't give any money until there's absolute compliance. There were all sorts of terrorism was going on. You can't give them money under these circumstances. It's 20 years later. There's a bill coming up to the Congress now not to give any more money to the Palestinian Authority. It took 20 years. It took 20 years. All right, that was a little footnote to history. A footnote to history. So I couldn't help it. It's nearly June 13th. What?
Did the Albany Journal?
Oh boy, did they have a front page article that pictures of all of the rabbis? Don't ask. All the Jewish papers, and I was not in the country at the time, but they tell me that that night on Israeli television, Yossi Perlman said, "Oh, Gold, he's an extremist from Brooklyn." Extremist from Har Noach. I'm sorry, you know, once in a person's lifetime you have a right to talk a little bit about history. It was a very important footnote to history, and one of the big writers a few months later, after the assassination, Michael Karpin wrote a book, Retzach B'Shem Elokim, Murder in the name of God, where of course he wanted to smear the entire religious and right wing. So he spends a chapter on me. Okay, I feel that's a badge of honor. Kalev is a visionary, and he expresses it very clearly. He's not going into any details, what's going to happen, what's not going to happen. He's not talking about demography, about military strategy. Because we can do it. How can you do it? How do you know? We can do it. How do I know that his visionary, maybe even insane remarks had an impact on the Jewish people? Or did it have an impact? You know, because a Jew, even if he strays, there's a neshama in there. The neshama hears messages. Right after this statement, it says, "Vayomru kol ha'om lirgom otam ba'avanim." The people said, "Let's stone them to death." Yoshua and Kalev. It's in the pasuk. It's in there in the pasuk. You'll read it. We're not going to get to it today, but Vayaru Kohaam, the whole nation said, stone them. I don't understand why stone them. There are 600,000 males from age 20 to 60. There was only 2.5 to 3 million people in the desert. And two people say, and of the two people, one of them. Yoshua, by the way, could not speak out because Yoshua understood that he is suspect, because they know already from Parshat Va'alotcha, from the prophecies of Eldad Umedad, that Moshe is going to die and Yoshua is going to lead them into Eretz Yisrael. Yoshua knows that he must remain silent, because if he gets up, they're going to say, "Well, you want to be the leader of the nation, that's why you want to go into Eretz Yisrael. You want to become the next president." No! The only one who could speak up without being accused of anything was Kalev. And he did it. And he did it. Now I ask you, if 3 million people don't want to go, and there's one Meshuggah who says, "We will go and we will inherit," just don't pay attention to them. Why do you want to stone them to death? So the Meshuggah dead and let him talk. Blah, blah, blah. That's all Kalev is. What are they worried about? Why do they have to stone him to death? Why should he even think of that? You know why they want to stone him to death? Because there's something about the truth that goes deep into the neshama. The Jew may be frightened and terrified. The miracle may have done a great job. But on some level, there's the feeling, you know what? Kalev speaks the truth. And we don't want to hear the truth now. And if you don't want to hear the truth, you know what you want to do? You want to destroy it. There are times that I have a feeling that all the pogroms against Jews throughout history, because we're the truth, and they don't want to hear the truth. And if you don't want to hear the truth, you try to destroy it utterly. Oh, did that statement of Colleen Penyafuna, did that make an impact? Where did Colleen get this strength? In the parish it says that when they came, the miracle came into Eretz Yisrael, one passage says, Vayovo ab Chevron. In singular, it says, and he came to Chevron. And Rashi brings the Gemara that says that Kalev separated himself from the Meraglim and he came to Chevron lehishtateach al kivrei avos, to prostrate himself by the graves of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. When he was in Chevron by Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, oh, did he get a message over there? Kalev, Avraham, certain told Avraham. Avraham says, Kalev, you know what? Sarah couldn't have children. By nature, she couldn't have children. Then she had a son, Yitzchak, at age 90. That's a miracle. A great miracle. That's not natural. Chalev, the entire existence of the Jewish people is one big miracle. Mess. Don't ever forget that. You are not. You don't live. Klausel doesn't live in the world of reality. In the world of reality, we would have disappeared 2,000 years ago. What are you talking about? What are we doing here? Kalev, I'm telling you, you can do it. The Rebbeinu promised me the land. He swore to me that my children are going to have the land. You're going to have the land. Yitzchak. Yitzchak says, hey, if you know how much trouble I had just because I wanted to do something good for the people, I dug wells for them, you understand? You think they thought me, they thanked me for it. You know what Yitzchak says? I'm the forgotten ally. I did so much for them. But you know what? The end is, we have to do for ourselves. And the Rebbeinu Shem swore to me that the land is going to be given to them. Kalev, be strong. Chazak v'ematz. Oh, do I have to tell you what Yaakov Avinu told him over there? Yaakov is, of course, the one who represents the one who had gone off into exile and suffered until he finally came back to Eretz Yisrael. And then he then has to go down to Mitzrayim and he says, oh, Yaakov tells him, you're out of Mitzrayim. The last time I was around, you understand, I died in Mitzrayim. Thank you for burying me in Eretz Yisrael. The Rebbeinu told me, Anochi Eidim Chom, I'm going to go down with you, and I'm going to take you up, and from there I'm going to take you to Eretz Yisrael. Kalev, you're going to Eretz Yisrael. Kalev comes back, and he hears what the Meraglim are saying. He has a different vision. The vision of Kalev is fueled by Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. But you know what? There's another major influence in Kalev's life. Can't ever overlook that major influence. He was married to Miriam. Miriam was his wife.
Miriam Hanivia,
she was the one who, when they were throwing Jewish babies into the Nile, and her father went and separated from her mother, she told him, your Zeta is worse than theirs. Paro is only destroying males, you're destroying females, so you can't do that, huh? And you should know, you're going to give birth to the one who's going to be the savior of Israel. Oh, did she have vision? This was a zivug made in heaven. Miriam and Kalev. And Miriam and Kalev suffered. They had a son, Chur. Korah was the one who stood up against the Jewish people at the golden calf, and he was killed. They cut him down. Korah was killed. Kalev has a background. Kalev has backbone. Kalev is a visionary. Kalev is one who can see beyond the here and the now. He's not weighed down with demography and military and heen and hair. He learned from Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov that Jewish existence is completely different. It's not part of the world of reality. It's part of the world of divinity. And therefore he can get up there and he can say, Olam na'aleh v'yirashnu. So we're going to go up. We're going to do it. We're going to make it. And he's there 45 years later. 45 years later. Whole generation is gone. Jews can't be realists. Jews have to be visionaries. Our whole existence is an existence of visionaries. We have to have the ability of a Rav Kook to say it to them and say it straight. Rav Kook saved the dignity of the Jewish people. And there were others, by the way. It's worthwhile to remember. I told you a few weeks ago about Herzl, who refused to shake the hand of the Pope or kiss his hand when he was ushered into the Pope's presence a few months before he died. There was also at a previous Pope's visit, it was one person who refused to go to Megiddo, where the Pope was sort of sneaking into Eretz Yisrael, and that was Rav Yitzchak Nissim, the Sephardi chief rabbi. Refused under any circumstances. He wants to come into our country. He comes in showing a passport, standing before an Israeli officer. Well, no shtick. We don't take any of this kind of stuff. But this was a story. So it started with Pierre Van Passenden in his interview with Luke, Harry Charles Luke. Harry Charles Luke. It's fascinating to Google him. Boy, there's a lot of pages that came out when I pressed print. Oh, it came out. And Colleen Ben Yefuna is the one who, as Rav Kook Bishato, saves the dignity of the Jewish people. And it's his words that remain ringing in our ears. That's it.
Bishato.
Can you close that? Can you close that? Don't be afraid.